Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Working from home? Conference calls?
You're still on mute, John.
With everything we have going on right now, it's never been more important to get the sleep we need. Quality sleep is a natural immune booster, and only the Sleep Number 360 smart bed senses your movements and automatically adjusts your comfort and support on both sides, your Sleep Number setting. So, all those other things we're doing to stay healthy and happy, well, they'll work better too. And now, during the lowest prices of the season, the Queen Sleep Number 360 C4 smart bed is only $12.99. Save $400, only for a limited time. To learn more, go to sleepnumber.com.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jeanette Jalil, and in the early hours of Monday, the 22nd of June, these are our main stories. The fire department in the US city of Tulsa says just over 6,000 people attended President Trump's campaign rally there on Saturday, about a third of the capacity at the venue. Brazil has now joined the United States in becoming only the second country to have more than 50,000 confirmed coronavirus deaths. Mutinous soldiers in the Somali capital, Mogadishu, have ended their protest over unpaid salaries after blocking roads leading to the presidential palace for a few hours. Also in this podcast...
One of the janitors said, if I tune the piano, can I record the concert and I'll give it to you?
A recording of an unusual 1968 appearance by the legendary jazz pianist Thelonious Monk is finally being released after more than 50 years. 4 years ago, Donald Trump's campaign team managed to harness the power of social media to help him win the US presidency. But could the tables have been turned in 2020? It's been claimed that users of the video sharing app TikTok and fans of South Korean K-pop music turned his much-hyped rally in Tulsa on Saturday night into a flop by falsely registering for tickets. The Trump team denies this and insists that about twice as many as the officially recorded 6,000 people turned up. But either way, the figures fall far short of the hundreds of thousands the Trump team said had asked for tickets. I heard more from our North America correspondent, Peter Bowes.
Since the rally, a number of people have come forward to make these claims about an apparent mass campaign to sabotage the rally's attendance numbers. The Democratic Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez tweeted that the president had been tricked into believing that a million people wanted to attend. She says teenagers on TikTok had flooded the Trump campaign with fake ticket reservations. Reportedly, this all started with a 51-year-old woman from Iowa who was angry at the original plan to hold the rally on June the 19th, Juneteenth, the day that marks the end of slavery in the United States. But it appears to have garnered support from fans of K-pop, South Korean pop music, politically active young people, users of TikTok in large numbers. And it's claimed this resulted in the huge discrepancy between the expected numbers and the actual numbers of people that turned up.
But even if TikTok users duped the Trump campaign, this doesn't explain why traditional Trump supporters stayed away in such big numbers.
Yeah, and that's why we should, I think, be cautious about these claims. There is a lot of noise about this apparently orchestrated attempt to disrupt the rally. Actual proof that these fake requests for tickets led to the dramatic reduction in the number of people there. That's harder to pin down. Other factors could be in play, not least just a genuine fear by people who may well support Donald Trump, but a fear that it was simply too risky from a public health standpoint to attend.
And the man himself will not be happy about these numbers.
No, and we've heard a lot from his campaign. The fire marshal at the event said 6,000 people turned up. The Trump campaign is now saying that 12,000 people passed through their metal detectors at the rally. So they're pushing back on the number from the fire marshal. The capacity in the arena is 19,000, so still far from a full room. And the Trump campaign says what they call the lame attempt at hacking was foolish because they say every rally is general admission, entry on a first-come, first-served basis, and prior registration isn't required. And they say the real reason people stayed away is a week's worth of, just to quote them, the fake news media warning people to stay away from the rally because of COVID and protesters, coupled with, they say, the images of American cities on fire. And the campaign says this had a real impact on people taking their families and children to the rally.
Peter Bowes. Just 2 days after passing the grim milestone of 1 million coronavirus cases, Brazil has now joined the United States in becoming only the second country to have more than 50,000 confirmed COVID-19 deaths. But health experts have warned that the outbreak hasn't yet reached its peak in the country, as more than 1,000 deaths are still regularly recorded every day. I heard more from our correspondent in Brazil, Katie Watson.
Just for some context, I'll talk you through the front page of one of the newspapers, Estado de São Paulo, which has thousands and thousands of little dots. And it says each dot represents lost life in the last 14 weeks. And then it goes on to say that this number of, 50,000 is not just a morbid statistic. It is the grief and pain of thousands of families, but it's also the ineptitude of the country in confronting the pandemic.
And this virus is really hitting the indigenous communities. There's talk of it wiping out a generation of leaders and tribal knowledge.
As you mentioned, some important indigenous leaders have either they've got COVID-19 or they have passed away from it. And in the last, we saw a few weeks ago that it was the Amazon that was really suffering. There were images of mass graves in Manaus, which is the biggest city in the Amazon, and they were struggling because it's a isolated area trying to get, healthcare there. It's overcrowded, it's under-resourced, and they were really, really hit hard. The pressure is starting to ease there, but nevertheless, the indigenous communities are so vulnerable, and the concern is that people coming in illegally, often illegal loggers, illegal miners, taking the waterways when they shouldn't be, it's that is leaving the indigenous people exposed when a lot of these communities have already shut themselves off because they know just how vulnerable they are.
And briefly, there's talk that Brazil could be even worse hit than the United States.
Well, look, I mean, the testing here in Brazil is woefully low. It's about 5% of what a lot of Europe tests. We're talking, really low numbers. And I mean, there are estimates anything from 7 to 15 times as many infections there could be compared to what the official statistics are showing.
Katie Watson in Brazil. India has the world's fourth highest number of coronavirus cases with well over 400,000 infections, despite a lockdown that lasted for months. The number who've died is relatively low at 13,000, but frontline workers in India have told the BBC that deaths have been underreported and the real number could be much higher. Our correspondent, Yukita Lamaya, reports.
Funeral pyres burn at a Hindu crematorium. Normally, final rituals are performed by families huddled together. Now, they're often done by strangers. Thousands of Indians have died of coronavirus. But from the stories coming out of the country's crematoriums, burial grounds and hospitals, there's evidence that the real number could be a lot higher. In Mumbai, the son of a man who died a few weeks ago said his father was not declared as infected by COVID-19 on his death certificate, even though he tested positive for the virus. He didn't want to be named, fearing reprisal for speaking out.
The hospital told us he died because of respiratory failure. We only found out he had coronavirus the day after we cremated him.
There are many more who are not being counted. Frontline doctors from different parts of India have told the BBC. Their voices have been changed because they too didn't want to be identified. A Mumbai doctor described why he believes there's underreporting of deaths.
We do not test those who are brought in dead. Even if they have COVID-like symptoms. Every day, around 6 to 7 patients are brought dead to our hospital.
A doctor in Ahmedabad alleged her hospital is concealing COVID-19 deaths.
The deaths are happening because of coronavirus, but they show the patients died of comorbidities like hypertension or diabetes. The number of deaths is more than what they are showing.
In the national capital, Delhi, a government doctor made a similar claim.
There is a massive underreporting in Delhi. In our isolation ward, 45 people have died in the past 3 weeks, out of which only 7 were tested. We don't know if they had COVID or not, but they definitely showed the symptoms.
For decades in Delhi, Jitendra Singh Shanti has been carrying the dead from hospitals to crematoriums in his fleet of ambulances. He and his team even performed the last rites for unclaimed bodies. He told me how overwhelmed they are because of the coronavirus crisis.
We used to transport about 5 bodies a day, but now that number has increased to up to 25. The situation in Delhi is really bad.
This week, authorities in both Mumbai and Delhi updated official death tolls with hundreds of previously unreported cases. They say they're working to ensure correct numbers are available. But the deaths that make it to official COVID data are overwhelmingly those that occur in hospitals. In India, more than half of the deaths, even in urban areas like Mumbai, take place at home. And in rural parts where coronavirus has now reached, that proportion is even higher. Many of these deaths are recorded with local authorities, but even during normal times, there are often long delays, which are likely to be worse in the midst of a pandemic.
That report by Yogita Limaye in India. Now to Somalia, and soldiers who say they haven't been paid for months have held protests in the Somali capital, Mogadishu. For several hours, they blocked roads near the presidential palace. There are reports that the troops had recently been fighting against the jihadist group Al-Shabaab in the south of the country. I heard more from our Africa editor, Will Ross.
Well, it appears now that the soldiers have taken down their roadblocks and left the streets of Mogadishu. They were basically blocking vehicles from moving along several roads near the presidential palace, which of course raised quite a lot of alarm in the city. But it's not clear whether they've managed to find a solution to this pay dispute. I mean, some of the soldiers who were filmed by local media in Mogadishu were saying that they hadn't been paid for well over a year, some saying as long as 18 months. So this is obviously a big problem within part of the Somali army. What we don't know is how deep the problem is, whether this is a small group of disgruntled soldiers or a kind of an example of something that's bigger and more widespread that could, you know, grow and make the threat greater in the future.
I was going to ask you how big a problem this is, soldiers not being paid. I mean, why wouldn't they be paid?
Well, it has been a problem in the past. We don't know at the moment how big the problem is, but certainly over the last 3 years or so, there have been a number of problems of corruption within the military. And in fact, last year, international donors insisted that the Somali government paid all the soldiers through bank accounts, because what had been happening is commanders had been stealing the salaries from some of the junior soldiers. And that, of course, was causing all sorts of problems and disgruntlement within the military. And of course, you have to remember that these soldiers are involved in a very, very dangerous job of trying to protect the population against attacks by the Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab. So you'd think that the authorities would make absolutely sure that they're well looked after. But as I say, there have been problems with corruption before, and the authorities have tried to sort that out, have tried to reform, especially the way that the soldiers are paid.
Will Ross. Still to come in the podcast.
Around 30 Ethiopian women are sitting on the pavement and they've been dumped by their Lebanese employers.
We hear how maids in Beirut are being abandoned as the pandemic hits a country already buckling under an economic crisis. Police in England are treating a knife attack on Saturday in which 3 people were killed and 3 wounded as a terrorist incident. The British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, condemned the attack.
Well, I'm appalled and sickened that people should lose their lives in this way, and our thoughts are very much with the families and friends of the victims. If there are lessons that we need to learn about how we handle such cases, how we handle the events leading up to such cases, then we will learn those lessons and we will not hesitate to take action where necessary.
The victims were stabbed in a park in the town of Reading near London. Lawrence Wart was one of those who fled in terror.
Suddenly, just the man shouted and darted to the left, and I thought it was just a scuffle at first. Obviously, looking back now, I know that he was stabbing them, so he stabbed the first person, went round, because they were sat in a circle drinking, a big group, about 8 to 10 people, and he darted round anti-clockwise the circle, got one, went to another, stabbed the next one. Then he stood up, and I saw a massive knife in his hand, probably at least 5 inches minimum. And then he turned and started looking towards us. And that's when I just started shouting, run.
A 25-year-old man, Khairi Saidullah, was arrested at the scene. The BBC understands he is originally from Libya and that he came to the attention of the security services last year. Here's our security correspondent, Gordon Carrera.
Senior counter-terrorism officials had expressed concerns that as the lockdown lifted, the threat could return. Crowded places have been a primary target and they simply didn't exist during the pandemic. But as crowds could once again gather in places like parks, the fear was always that a pent-up desire to carry out an attack could quickly find an outlet. There were also concerns that individuals may have spent more time online while trapped at home, and that could have led to increased radicalisation. It is early days in this case and much remains unclear, including precise motivation. But the incident in Reading does fit a familiar pattern, that of a lone actor with few other connections, using a weapon that was easy to obtain.
Gordon Carrera. Lebanon was already in a state of economic collapse before the coronavirus, but the lockdown has meant that many middle-class Lebanese can now no longer afford their maids. And so, in the past few days, more than 100 Ethiopian migrant workers have been abandoned outside their embassy in Beirut. From the Lebanese capital, Martin Patience reports.
Around 30 Ethiopian women are sitting on the pavement. One of them is lying on the ground on a mattress, and they've been dumped by their Lebanese employers outside the embassy. There's a big pile of suitcases and plastic bags, everything that the women here own. One of the women is 20-year-old Lomi. She's been working in Lebanon for a year and a half as a domestic maid. She tells me she's now been thrown away like rubbish. Lomi says she hasn't been paid her salary in 4 months, but that she no longer cares. She just wants to be able to go home. But Beirut Airport is closed because of the coronavirus lockdown. And even if it was open, who would pay for a ticket? Some other migrant workers are bringing food to help those stuck outside the embassy.
Really, with humanity, I can't see them like this. Tomorrow, what's going on with me? Maybe I'm with them tomorrow.
There are 250,000 migrant workers in Lebanon, and the majority of them are from Ethiopia. But the country's notorious sponsorship system means these workers have almost no rights.
This system is a system that enables modern-day slavery in our houses.
Farah Salka is the director of Lebanon's anti-racism movement.
You tell them where to work, when to work. You can tell them to work at your house and your friends' houses, your mom's house, your sister's house, whatever you want. And then you can decide not to pay them. They could die in your house. Nobody asks you if you've been paying them, if you extended the contract by force, la, la, la. Nobody asks you anything. And then, to top all this, in the crisis we're in, you can decide, you know what, I'm done. You take this woman, this worker, you drop her at her consulate or on the street, and that's done. In a normal case scenario, you'd be taken to prison for this, right? Is anybody taken for prison for this in Lebanon? No. So yes, it is modern-day slavery.
The Lebanese government says it's doing all it can to help the workers, given the country's economic crisis. Marlene Atallah is the acting director general of the Ministry of Labour.
When we know there is a number of Ethiopian workers new to the embassy, our minister takes the initiative and coordinates directly with the consul of Ethiopia and with the general security. And we send this worker at the hotel for 2 days. And after, we send it to a shelter.
But Mrs. Atallah admits that no employer has been prosecuted for ditching their worker. but says investigations are ongoing. We asked the Ethiopian embassy for a comment, but got no response. At the moment, many countries are facing a reckoning with racism. Lebanon's a nation where migrant workers are being openly discarded. And these workers have no idea when or if they'll ever get home.
Martin Patience reporting from Beirut. Throughout the pandemic, questions have been asked about whether there are lessons to be learned from global health emergencies of the past, from HIV/AIDS to the Spanish flu to the bubonic plague. But should we go even further back? Does a plague that ravaged the ancient democracy of Athens between 430 and 429 BC have even more pertinent parallels with today? Gary Bass is a professor of politics and international affairs at Princeton University, and he's been writing about the Athenian plague. He told James Kumarasamy about the backdrop to this ancient pandemic.
This is in Athens, the world's first democracy, and it's in the age of Pericles, the great Athenian leader. So you have the fabulous public architecture of the Parthenon, the plays of Euripides and Aristophanes, but you also have a city that's in the early stages of a terrible 27-year-long war against the militaristic Spartans. So Athenian society is already under that kind of wartime pressure. And Athens is eventually going to lose this war, in part because of the impact of this plague.
And what do we know about the plague itself?
So we know, most of what we know is from a great Athenian historian called Thucydides, who wrote a history of this great war between Athens and Sparta, one of the most famous books ever written on international politics, cited to this day by everybody from Woodrow Wilson to Xi Jinping to Boris Johnson, who's a great fan of Pericles. And you would not want to get this disease. Thucydides got it and survived, but it brought bleeding and vomiting and fever and worse. People died within about a week. Something like tens of thousands of people died, as many as one-third of all Athenians.
Yet the actual details of what it was still a bit hazy?
Nobody really knows what it was. There are sort of classically minded epidemiologists who debate about it to this day, whether it was smallpox or a kind of fungal poisoning or a flu or a variety of other horrible possibilities.
But the impact of it, the political impact of it, can we say for certain?
Thucydides tells us that you had a very orderly city that now goes through something close to complete social collapse, that people were expecting to die at any minute, and they didn't expect to live long enough to be punished for crimes. So the city plunges into lawlessness. And politically, there's terrible damage. It takes something like 15 years for the military to recover, which is great news for the Spartans. And the plague kills off the greatest Athenian politician, Pericles, and it leaves democracy in the hands of sort of a new group of politicians, of demagogues and goons. And this corrupted democracy makes a series of terrible, cruel, stupid decisions, which contribute to their eventual defeat at the hands of the Spartans.
What parallels and lessons would you see in this for today, then?
So it's always a little risky reading lessons from antiquity, but here's one is about scapegoating. Many Athenians thought this plague must be the fault of the Spartans. And Thucydides says this is nonsense, which is kind of an ancient reproach to people like Donald Trump and his Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, trying to distract attention away from their own catastrophic response to coronavirus by screaming at China.
As you say, one always has to be careful about making any parallels in history, let alone with antiquity. But can they be useful? Do you think leaders, as you say, who still like to quote from this time, can they draw lessons? Would it be useful for them to look back?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think you always benefit from reading Thucydides, from knowing more history, than when you go through the world with only one historical example in mind, then everything looks like Munich or everything looks like Vietnam. The more history you know, the more that you're familiar with, the more you can see patterns and rhymes.
Professor Gary Bass from Princeton University. A recording of an unusual 1968 appearance by the legendary jazz pianist Thelonious Monk is finally being released after more than 50 years. The concert in California at the height of the civil rights movement wasn't the brainchild of a big promoter, but of a teenage fan, as Nicholas Stanbridge has been discovering.
It wasn't the smoky jazz clubs Thelonious Monk was used to, but a high school hall and piano with a squeaky bench at the request of 17-year-old Danny Scher, who paid $500 selling ads to local shops to see his music idol.
We worked out a deal. The principal of the school signed the contract, sent it back. It was right after Martin Luther King was shot. There was tension in the area. I'm putting up posters in East Palo Alto, which is predominantly black. Police are telling me, hey, kid, you better get out of here. You know, this isn't really safe for you. And I said, well, you know, I got a show to put on and, you know, Monk will be great. A few days before the concert, I called up Monk and he said, what are you talking about? And he said, well, I knew nothing about it, but how am I going to get there? And I said, well, my brother's old enough to drive, so he can come and get you. The parking lot was filled with East Palo Alto. Everyone buys their tickets. One of the janitors said, if I tune the piano, can I record the concert and I'll give it to you? And I said, sure. It sells out. You know, it was a timeout. I had a great time, got the tape, and I put it away for 50 years.
He eventually played it to Thelonious' son, the musician T.S. Monk.
It's quite a recording. He was in full swing. Epistrophe, the composition that kicked the door open for generations of jazz musicians. When I said I want to play the drums, he did two things which were fantastic. He called the great drummer Art Blakey. A set of drums showed up at the house from Art Blakey. And then he called Max Roach and he said, hey, Max, the kid wants to play the drums and you're the greatest drummer in the world. And I'm sending them to your house. Click!
The time this concert was recorded has some echoes with what's going on now with the Black Lives Matters campaign. Thelonious Monk was an advocate for rights.
Thelonious had been a victim of traveling through the South in the 1930s and 40s. And he also did fundraisers for the great Paul Robeson. You know, Palo Alto was very segregated. And there was a movement at the time to rename East Palo Alto Nairobi. Never came to pass, but that was the vibe that was in the air. You know, Thelonious was a genius, not only melodically and harmonically, but he was a genius rhythmically. And the dancing that Thelonious did actually based on ancient African dance. Thelonious is known as the high priest of bebop, but Thelonious was in fact the father of modern jazz because of the harmonic and melodic innovations that Thelonious brought to the table. When I do clinics with high school kids, I will tell them, no monk, no funk.
I once mentioned about 2004, I did this concert. We made a deal. Toots signed it October 10th. 2017, because that was his father's 100th birthday. I always thought there was something there. Music for that day just brought us all together, like music does.
That's not to say that that changed what was going on in Palo Alto, but it was the beginning.
By way of a footnote, Danny Scher would go on to repeat his success, still at high school, with Duke Ellington.
Looking for the Monk recording is when I found the Duke Ellington. Maybe that'll be the next recording that I release.
That report by Nicholas Stanbridge. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
Hello there, I'm Ed Butler.
And I'm Manuela Saragossa. And we're the presenters of the Business Daily podcast from the BBC World Service.
Now, we have been asked to tell you all about our podcast and why you should listen to it. So, Manuela, what is Business Daily all about?
You know, Ed, that's a really difficult question because it does a lot more than it says on the tin. I mean, it talks about money, work, the economy, the office, the big policy issues.
Maybe we shouldn't be called Business Daily at all. Maybe we should have another name like In the Money, On the Money, With the Money. Here's Manuela with the money. That makes you sound like a drug dealer.
It does. Crystal ball gazing, I thought.
Oh, interesting.
Because we do a lot of looking at the future of work and industry. And curveballs as well, because we do throw our listeners some pretty random stuff, like how to be mediocre and still love yourself, or the business case for sleep.
Mystic Manuela, ahead of the curve. Okay, you lot at home, you get to decide. Give us a listen, tell us what you think, and perhaps tell us what to call ourselves.
Just look for BBC Business Daily wherever you download your podcasts.
Business Daily, then.
Business Daily.